I guess we'll actually start, though, if you could say your name and spell it for us.
Sure. Do you want me? You want me looking at this lad? Okay.
You look right at this beautiful face here.
All right.
The moneymaker. and your date of birth.
Okay. My name is Robert O'Boyle, R-O-B-E-R-T, O apostrophe capital B-O-Y-L-E. I was born in Great Falls, Montana, 1974.
And you're married, is that right?
Correct. I'm married to Virginia O'Boyle. She was raised in Loma, Montana, central Montana there. And yeah, we've been married for 12 years.
12 years, okay. Do you have any kids?
We have two kids. We have Liam Padraig, he's 7, and Mariah, and she is 11 years old.
They go to school out here in Potomac?
They do. They okay. do. They go to school in Potomac.
Good. And so you grew up most of your life in Great Falls, is that right?
Yeah, most up till about, I lived in Great Falls till I was 19, 20 years old.
Okay. You still have family there?
Yes. Yes. My mother still lives in Great Falls. Two of my sisters live in Great Falls, as well as my sister-in-law. Mm-hmm.
And you have some family in other parts of the state, right?
I do have family in other parts of the state. Quite a bit of family in Butte. Mm-hmm. My brother lives there. Aunts and lots of cousins over there. Mm-hmm. Growing up, that was really like a second home. My grandparents lived in Butte. My folks moved out of Butte after a while, but my grandparents lived there. My maternal grandparents, the Kelly side of my family, lived there. And so at least once a month, we'd go over to Butte and spend some time there. All through grade school and stuff, we'd go over. My grandparents would usually come over as well once a month or so, and or we'd meet somewhere in the middle. A lot of times we'd meet in at Holter Lake and go fishing and stuff.
But. Okay. You're saying you spent quite a bit of time in the summer in Butte, is that right?
Yeah, in the summertime, especially when I got a little bit older, I mean a little bit older, like 8, I would go over there and stay with my aunt and my cousin. There was 3 of us born pretty close together. And we were all born in 74. My cousin Sam was born in February. My cousin Anna was born at the beginning of September, and then myself. And so Anna didn't live in Butte. She lived in Kentucky. But my cousin Sam and I were really close to the same age, so we spent a lot of time together. I'd go over and spend a month or two every summer over there.
Okay. What would an average day running around with Sam in Butte be like?
The average day of running around in Butte with Sam, it was one of those deals where maybe nothing's average, but
right.
Of course nobody drank the water because it was all poison. So my aunt would always give us we'd have a supply of Mountain Dew, so we'd have a lot of caffeine and sugar, and then we would just run around and play. We'd play in the mines. We'd run all over and climb on stuff. There was always, you know, there was quite a bit of things to get into in Butte. We'd go down to Whitehead's, and which is a knife shop there, and we'd pick up different instruments of destruction, like boomerangs and little knives, and we'd go run around the town having fun with those. And we'd go over to the mining museum quite a bit, and we'd ride around. They had a trolley, and we'd just jump on the trolley, you know, the tour. They had a tour trolley that we'd ride around on and stuff and everything. Of course, go up to our grandparents. Our grandparents lived in Centerville, and then which is really close to Walkerville up the hill there. And so they lived on, first they lived on La Platte Street, which is kind of right at the edge of Centerville. And then their house burnt down there, and then they moved to Center Street. And so we'd go up there quite a bit as well.
Yeah. When the house burned down, did you lose a lot of stuff as far as you know family-wise?
Yeah, there was quite a bit that was lost, although my grandparents weren't kind of the pack rats of the family, so to speak. And so a lot of that had been distributed. Of course, there was stuff that was lost. A lot was burned and stuff. But not as bad as it could have been, I guess. So. Yeah.
So what are, with the Butte connections, what are the Irish connections with the family?
Sure. The Irish connections with my family, it's on both sides of the family. With the maternal side, my mom's side of the family, my mom's maiden name was Kelly. Going back, there's several different generations of Irish, and that as we come this way, they, like so many, had relatives over in Butte and ended up following them over. And similar with my dad's side of the family, although they came over earlier. The O'Boyle side, they came over in 1851, as kind of during the Great Hunger. A lot of people were leaving, of course, and that's when the O'Boyle bunch, some of them left over. And getting to Montana, it so happened that my great-grandpa, who was named Francis John O'Boyle, his wife, my great-grandma, died in childbirth after having 9 children. And the kids were kind of distributed about, and there was quite a bit of family there. And so they in Butte, my grandfather ended up there. And some of them went to, actually there were some in Missoula. My Aunt Eileen and another relative, I can't remember, end up going to Loyola Sacred Heart here. After their mother passed. And so they were over there. I also had, again, on my dad's side, his mother, they were Hamels and Davidsons on that side, and they were in Anaconda, again, mining and stuff. And so there was quite a bit of that. But
the slew, huh? What is, I guess this is kind of a generic question, but what does your Irish ancestry mean to you? Like, how does that connect with you?
Sure. With me, it's always been kind of a big deal because, well, for a living, my Irish ancestry means a lot because for a living, for instance, I'm an anthropologist. I study culture and work with people on their culture. And so it's always been a big part of me keeping that grounded. Growing up, it was always kind of a big deal. It was a sense of connectedness. This is who we are. It was part of everyday life. You know, it wasn't a once a year put on a plastic hat St. Patrick's Day Irish. It was, you know, it went throughout the year, included song, food, you know, all those things. One of the things that for my generation now, looking at it, we're looking at language and stuff because that was lost with my grandparents. They could speak some Irish, but it wasn't passed down because it wasn't seen as significant. What is this going to do? It's not going to help anything. And so now I'm, you know, working with my kids and stuff and in that respect, and that's been a big deal. But no, it means a lot.
What form does that take when you're working with your kids on that?
Typically with my kids, we actually started when Terry O'Riordan started the Irish Studies program here. The language with the kids came about really at the beginning. Mariah was born in 2000, and Terry started teaching Irish in January of 2001 here at the University of Montana. And I was in his first class, and Mariah would come to me with that, to that class, and she picked up on some there, and we still kind of, now it's just little things that we do, little things that we say, you know, come here, sit down, you know, Is that good? Are you hungry? Are you full? Are you done? Just basic type of things like that. But it still ties that thread back, you know, and that's important. It changes the way, you know, I kind of regret in a lot of ways because it's a different perspective on how to think. It puts you in a different mindset because of the way the language is put together. And so that's something I try and just make my kids aware of in general. Just not only with Irish, but other people that, you know, not everybody thinks the same as we do. And here's examples of how that works.
That's cool. You mentioned food and music and stuff as part of your growing up and part of your heritage. What are some examples of that?
Some examples of music with my heritage. My family's related to the Clancy brothers from Carrickenshaw there in Ireland through my my father's mother's side of the family. And so that was kind of the celebrity connection within our family, you know, to the Clancy brothers. We'd listen to that music a lot when I was growing up. We always had that playing. We'd listen to the Dubliners. We'd listen to different things. And of course, then as I got older, I'd listen to you know, the Pogues and other things, just for the Irish connection, you know. But it was always a big deal. And, you know, as I passed from a child growing up then to a dad, that's one thing that I've made sure with my kids, you know, I'd always be singing them Irish songs, putting them to bed at night. And we still listen to a lot of Irish music all the time. And so that's a big deal. With the food, as far as growing up, that's always been kind of a thing with our family as far as heritage and food, because you know, you get together, you break bread, you share a meal. It's a big deal, and it's kind of interesting, the mixing of Irish and American as far as that goes. My mom had pasties. She would make pasties because her mother made pasties, and Grandma Kelly's pasties were always just so good. And they've actually kind of wrecked me for my mother's pasties. Have kind of wrecked me for other pasties when I go around. I order one in a restaurant or something. It's just kind of sad, and I can't really deal with it. But that was one. But there was a lot of times, you know, we'd get together, you know, of course, on St. Patrick's Day, and we'd have corned beef and cabbage, and we'd always have meat and potatoes, and there'd be things like, for instance, here, where this still goes on. Last night, we had parsnip soup, which is kind of an Irish dish. And, we have a lot of different things that we cook and do. We cook a coddle, which is kind of it's a mix of sausages and potatoes. It's kind of of course, coddle means sleepy. It's a comfort food. And so it's kind of a pub grub, you know, kind of, and fills you up and makes you feel good. But that's always been kind of a cultural thing, I guess. Whenever you go to my aunt's house there in Butte still, she lives down on West Pearl Street, and just down from the Goodwill Bar in which used to be called Corktown right there. But that's where she lives still. And you go over to my aunt's house, and she'll say, well, Bobby, you look hungry. Let me get you a sandwich. And I say, no, I'm all right, Aunt Mar. No, come on, I'm going to fix you a sandwich. You want, and you'll have a sandwich too, Virginia? Okay, I'll make you a sandwich, and we'll have, here, I'll make you a ham. We'll grill this up. No, it's you know, it's just kind of, it's forced upon you more than anything. But that's always been kind of that hospitality, and food's been a big part of that hospitality. Mm-hmm. And there always has been kind of a Irish overtone to it.
Yeah, you mentioned St. Paddy's Day a few times. Like, what mm-hmm. what was that like when your grandparents were still around? I mean, how big of a get together did you have?
Yeah, it was always a big deal. None of us ever went to school on St. Patrick's Day. that wasn't even an issue. Almost every year since I can remember, we went to Butte for St. Patrick's Day. I still take my kids over there almost every year. We go over, and it isn't the go hang out at the bars and, you know, drink and all that type of stuff. We'd go over and get together, and we'd have food, you know, part of that. Go to the parade over in Butte and see that. And a lot of times we'd go to, like, the Elks Club or something and watch they'd have bands, and we'd go see music and everything at those. And that was more what our experience was with it, and rather than the wading through Park Street with the throngs of college kids having fun and breaking stuff. Of course, my cousin Sam and I, every once in a while, have to drive down there and see what's going on and see if there's any trouble we can cause.
That's good. Is Sam still in Butte now?
Sam's still in Butte, yep.
Still pretty close?
Yeah, we are. We're not as close as we used to be, but we still talk, you know, regular, you know, and I, you know, he'll call me on my birthday. I call him on his birthday. If I'm over in Butte, I stop and see him. One of the things with some of my relatives in Butte, they don't know that road actually goes out as well as in. They always want you to come over there, but they hardly ever get out. And so we go over and see them, though, quite a bit, you know. We'll spend time. My kids got to go over this summer. We went over for the 3rd of July. Of course, they have their big celebration on the 3rd and then the parade on the 4th. We went over for the 3rd of July, and my cousin Sam got to take my kids out and do fireworks and start some stuff on fire and everything. So they had a good time with that, and got good cousin Sam experiences of their own.
Passing that rowdy tradition on.
Exactly.
Speaking of rowdy traditions, you what was your school in, like, in Great Falls?
When I went to school in Great Falls, I went to a Catholic elementary school. It was, my siblings had some of them had spent some time in Catholic school and everything. Ideally, I think my mom would have wanted all of us to go through that, but I was the last of my bunch. I'm the youngest by 12 years. I'm the last of five kids, and so I was younger and everything, but I got to go through Catholic elementary school. And of course, going to a Catholic school, there was a lot of Irish at the Catholic school. The school I went to was called Holy Family, and it was good, small classes. You know, being Catholic and Irish, there was a lot of nuns and a lot of priests, and you know, one of the priests there was Father Maher, and you know, we'd really, Sister Gabriel, she was from Ireland. And she'd always come over to me and say, "Bobby O'Boyle, I'm going to take you home and put you in my Irish stew," and she'd pinch my cheeks and everything, you know. And so I had a lot of fun with that. And it was kind of the Irishness in growing up in that kind of framework was really made me feel good, because it was kind of, oh boy, you're kind of extra Catholic or extra, you know, it was kind of a funny deal or something, but it was good. As I went on after elementary school, I went on to the public schools, and it was a lot bigger, and it was kind of crazy. Central wasn't open then. They closed down for a while, and so there was no Catholic high school or anything. So I was tossed in from a class of, initially we had about 12 students in our school when I started in kindergarten. Sometime around fifth or sixth grade, they consolidated three of the parishes into one school. And so St. Gerard's, St. Peter and Paul's, and Holy Family consolidated into one school, and they called it Blessed Trinity then. And when they did that, I think my class ballooned to 25 or so kids in it. And but that was nothing when I went to high school then. Here I enter a class, there's 400 kids in the class. you know, you're dealing with class sizes and the number of people and everything. It was quite a change.
I'd say so. Yeah. I'd say so. And so was Catholicism? It was clearly functional in your family. Was mm-hmm. What kind of role did that play besides the school?
Well, it was a big deal, you know. The Catholicism played into my family, I think particularly for my generation in a different way than it did before. My mom, she'll probably be canonized, I would guess. I like all kids, I think my mom's a saint in a lot of ways. My nephew and I were talking the other day, and he said, you know, I can't think of anybody who doesn't like grandma or would have a bad thing to say about grandma. And I said, you know, I think you're right. But it was really, really important to her. Now, my dad, it wasn't as important, and especially when I was a kid, you know, it was a thing that he would do this and that, you know, but it was always kind of my mom's deal and that. But he really participated as I got a little bit older, you know, he was active in the school with me. He was the head of the PTC, you know. He made sure to be a part of that education in that Catholic school, and that was a big part of it. You know, we'd go to church and every Sunday and everything, and of course, going to school at the Catholic school, I was a altar boy. There was two of us, Jason Dexter and myself, that would alternate. There was other kids who would do it once in a while, but it seemed like the burden fell to the two of us to be altar boys every morning. And so we did a lot of that. So from about second grade to about sixth grade, I got to go to church almost 5 days a week, or 6 days a week a lot of times, because we do that. But we had a great guy, Monsignor Gluchek, who was there, who would say the morning masses from Monday to Thursday. And Monsignor was a survivor of Dachau. He was in the concentration camps over there. And I was a you know, a little kid in school and being an altar boy and stuff. And I said to my mom one day, I said, Mom, Monsignor says mass so slow, I'm late for school every day. Because school started, you'd go in. Mass started at 8 o'clock, and I think school probably started around 8:30. But a lot of times, Monsignor wouldn't get done until about 8:45. So I said to my mom, you know, Mom, geez, I'm late for school all the time because Monsignor. And she said, Bobby, Monsignor's a saint. He's going to be a saint tonight. And I said to her, I said, well, does that mean they're going to bury his bones in the altar when he dies? And of course, now it's actually something where he is on the road to canonization. He was kind of an amazing guy and really a special guy who, as far as my Catholicism went, shaped the way that I understood the rules. You know, there's rules to everything, and he was very, very deliberate with everything. He'd say, in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost. Amen. You know, and it was that deliberate. Every time he said Mass was like the first time you knew he was there. And so now, time comes this way. I'll go to church with my mom or something, and these guys are just talking, and there's people playing guitars, and it's a different experience. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, growing up, that kind of spoiled me, because I get frustrated. I go, this isn't right. They shouldn't be talking during Mass. They shouldn't be doing this or that. And it's part of that, you know, that habitualization going through.
But. Sure, absolutely. What did your... Stan, kind of with your growing up, what did your folks do for a living?
Sure. Initially, my dad, he went into the Navy. They lived in Butte then. Both my brothers, I have two older brothers. One of them left about 6 years ago, passed away. But they were both born in Butte. And my dad went to the Navy there, and my mom just raised them. But my dad came back. He worked in the mines a little bit, really on the tail end of when that was going on, though. The mines were closing down, and he and his brother, Pat, my dad's name was Mike, so it was Mike and Pat O'Boyle. They were in on closing some of those mines, and my dad told me a lot of stories about how crazy that dynamiting, you know, to close shafts and different things. But he went on, he was a hod carrier, carrying bricks for a bricklayer, you know, that old song, Finnegan's Wake. You ever heard that one? It's an old Irish song, and it's actually the book Finnegan's Wake was based on the song, the James Joyce book Finnegan's Wake. But in that, Tim Finnegan carried a hod to rise in the world. He carried a hod, and so a hod carrier is carrying these bricks, and so my dad did that for a long time. Even when they end up moving over to Great Falls, he had some connection there because his dad worked for the railroad, Consolidated Freightways. But when he moved over, he did some work with them, and he also did work with bricklaying and that. And then my brothers, similarly, both did cement. My brother that's still around, Mike, he lives over in Butte. He still does cement. That's what all, you know, was really kind of the thing. My cousin Patty, he does cement. It was, you know, you work and do that type of stuff. My mom worked for JCPenney's in Great Falls. And she worked for them for over 40 years, 42 years or something. And part of what they both did, it was always a big deal. You work hard and you don't give up on anything, you know. And so I think that's part of why my mom worked there so long. Because, you know, you put in the work and you're there. And she's still now, my mom, 72. Yeah. And she still can work circles around most folks. I mean, I know she'll come over to my house here and she'll wear us out. And growing up, that was always kind of a thing. My siblings and I, we always dreaded Tuesdays. Tuesdays was the day my mom had off work. And in the summer, boy, she'd line us out and give us a bunch of chores. And we'd always be doing stuff. She'd say, okay, well, I want you to go clean out the shed and we're going to, you know, repaint the picnic tables and we're going to do this and that. You'd just be going, oh my gosh. But that's kind of what they did for a living.
Sure. You mentioned you've hunted a lot. Can you kind of tell me about how you got into that and how it played out in your family?
Sure. Hunting was, from the time I was born, was a big deal. I mean, that was something that my dad always did. I mean, before me, my dad, He bought a gun when he was 12 or 13 years old. He bought a little .22 and he went out and shot a deer with it and stuff and everything. But growing up, it was a big part. Before I came along, because later on, after my dad did hod carrying and bricklaying and stuff, he went on to be a civil servant at the Air Force Base in Great Falls. And so after he did that, and he did that for 30-some years, we were pretty set as a family financially. I mean, it wasn't something we struggled with. But before that, when he was doing bricklaying and hod carrying and that, and amongst bartending and causing trouble and other sorts of mayhem, money was tight, and so they would hunt year round, you know, to feed the family and stuff. And so when I came along, that wasn't a need, but it was definitely something that I picked up from a young age. Even when I was really little, 3, 4, I'd go with my dad and we'd shoot guns all the time. I had, for Christmas, when I turned 5, I got a BB gun. And I went out, I wanted to go hunting. I was 5 years old. And we had these friends that lived just outside of town towards Vaughan, outside of Great Falls. And I said, "Dad, do you think that Bob would let me go hunting out here?" And he said, "Well, you better go ask him." So I went and talked to him, you know, as a little kid. I said, "Be okay." And I went out and I shot a rabbit on Christmas with the new BB gun. So what I didn't know at the time was that my dad's friend, Bob, was his wife was feeding these rabbits and they'd come up and get food. So here I thought I was this grand hunter at 5 when I really just shot one of the kind of semi-tamed, semi-domesticated rabbits that were around his place. But from there it went on, you know. And when I turned 7, my dad took me out and I shot my first deer when I was 7. And went out and part of it was teaching where does your food come from? Because now, especially, we're really getting more and more divorced from that concept. But he said, "I want you to know how to do this." So I'm 7 years old and I shot this deer. And he took me out to gut it and he said, "Okay." He goes, "I'm going to show you this once. Pay attention, because this is your job from now on." So he showed me, and then, then I kept doing that and stuff. But I, all along, you know, since then, I've always hunted almost every year. There's been a couple of years I've been really busy with work and this and that, but it's always something that's important. And with my kids, I want to kind of teach them that same lesson. You know, there's a part of that, an honesty to it. You go out and hunt, and we butcher it all ourselves. You know, we take it from the field to the freezer, and everything. It isn't. We don't send it off to people to cut up or anything. So,
it's cool. It's fun. I like that. What would you say from an anthropological level? What would you say, like, connection Irish culture does or is a part of?
Sure. With from an anthropological point of view, Irish culture makes me, for me, and I can only, of course, speak for myself, but it makes me a part of a group. You know, ethnicity means I'm part of a people. And, you know, growing up, that was a big part of it. You know, you go around to my family and stuff, and it still is a big part of how we define ourselves and how we define others, you know. I told my wife when we were getting together, I said, "You know, I should probably tell you this." I said, "I wasn't really raised with prejudice in my family. There wasn't a whole lot of that, but I said there really was with English, you know. It was really goddamn cousin Jack's, that type of thing, you know. It was really derogatory." And I still, even though it's not, you know, I really don't have anything against anybody, but I'll see a show with British people on it and I really have a hard time dealing with it. It's just kind of obnoxious to me in a way, because it sounds condescending and this and that, but I know it's just the way people talk. So looking at that, if I put on my anthropologist hat, part of that is defining not only who I am through song and culture, you know, food and language and sayings and all those things that go into making up an ethnicity, but it's also who we're not, or not them, and we're united against that bunch, you know. And so there's a cohesion that comes about from that. I think that now, yeah, I think also from an anthropologist point of view, I think, and I've had discussions with several of my friends from Ireland about this, that there's a more fierce Irish nationalism in a way in America than there is with the Irish Irish. Part of what's happened in America is you kind of have to overemphasize and beat your chest a little bit. Say, by golly, this is who I am, you know. Whereas other people are a little, you know, people from Ireland might be a little bit more relaxed with it. Of course, it goes, you know, extremes on both sides there and everything like that. But that's something that I think historically you can see that. I know with my grandfather, you know, there was, oh, I won't eat pasties. Now, these are the same pasties that I told you have spoiled me for all others, but well, those were English in origin, so we don't want those, you know, because they came from Cornwall and the mines in Cornwall and that. And so it's just kind of those things that are kind of funny, you know, that people do and hold on to. But yeah.
Interesting. So how tell me about the kind of work you do now a bit.
Yeah, the work that I do now is I'm an anthropologist, archaeologist. I do kind of a wide range of things dealing with people and culture from, you know, what's in the ground as an archaeologist to what people are going to be doing in the future as far as curating artifacts and even preserving language and archiving materials, historical documentation. That I work extensively with the folks up at the Rocky Boys Indian Reservation in north central Montana. That's the Chippewa Cree tribe up there. I'm the tribal archaeologist for them. And so I work with them on everything from compliance with cultural resource laws, because whenever there's federal money or federal permitting involved with a project that's going to disturb some ground or anything, they need cultural clearance on it. They need compliance with the National Historic Preservation Act. And as an archaeologist, I go and look for physical manifestations, but I also work closely with tribal elders and traditional cultural people up there to identify any significant cultural items that may be impacted by projects. We're also working on building a learning center up there for them. They're at a juncture where, you know, there's a lot of old timers leaving. This is any time though that you lose so much knowledge all the time. And so we're working on trying to preserve that knowledge for the next generation up there. Oral histories, photographs, all that type of stuff. We're building a website for them and putting that all together. But I've also worked not only with tribes. I've also worked with the Blackfeet. I've also worked with the Crow, a little bit with the Salish Kootenai. I have a lot of friends in Indian country, but I've also done other similar work with non-native communities. I did a oral history project in the Missouri River Breaks, and I talked to a lot of folks there about what they did for a living, how they lived down there and stuff. So it was pretty interesting.
What do you see in with the native cultures? What do you see as part of the kind of cultural identity side of that? How do you see that kind of playing out both
Sure.
before and maybe now?
Yeah, right now the bunch that I work with, the Chippewa Cree, are in a kind of an interesting position because That reservation wasn't established until 1917, so it was very late. 1916, 1917 is when they were getting the reservation established. And so the executive order came in, I believe, April of 1916. And so it's a fairly recent reservation. Before that time, these folks were traveling around quite a bit. And so we still have people up there who were alive before that reservation was formally established. We have one lady that I visited with several times, and she's actually on the original rolls from when they established the reservation. And so there's this link, very real link, to that kind of traveling time. Now, there's been a lot of acculturation happening, of course, because one of my friends up there, one of my close buddies, he's an elder up there, Duncan Standing Rock Senior. Duncan's the last guy who speaks the Ojibwe language up there, the Chippewa. Chippewa and Ojibwe are the same, so there's this feeling that things are getting lost, especially on that side of it. He laments that quite a bit. At the same time, there's still quite a few Cree speakers up there. There's a lot of the ceremonies still going on. People still remember that stuff. There's a lot of people with knowledge of the landscape, plants, places that tie them there through their language, and then the language ties them to the place. It's really, really interesting. I know as an anthropologist working, and even as a school kid, you see these maps. There's a map, and it'll say, well, this is Blackfeet country, and this is Crow country, and this, and they'll go through and they'll have these maps. And these old guys, they said to me, that's not really the way it was. Everybody shared this landscape, and we all moved about. And if a Blackfeet woman came over and married a Cree guy, she was Cree. She wasn't half Blackfeet, They're like, that was really a concept that didn't come about till that Dawes Allotment Act then set that whole blood quantum idea infused into Native culture. And so for them, there's still a lot of things intact that are still there, and we're working on making sure to keep those things alive and keep those things going, because they came up, they said, we for our department, I work in the cultural preservation department up there, and with the elders and some of the traditional folks, we said, we've got to have a kind of a mission statement. I said, we should have I really was looking for a vision statement that we could drive everything through, but they came up with a mission statement. And they had the Cree folks up there. Cree is, of course, not what they call themselves. That was a name missionaries gave them, Cristino. And then it was shortened to Cree and that. But they're the Nehu'inoa, four-bodied people. And so they said, well, four concepts that we want to make sure and include is we want the life of our people, how they live today and how they'll live tomorrow, the history, how people have got here, the language. That's a big component for them. They're always telling me, they say, Dr. Bob, you've got to learn Cree if you're going to really understand us. You've got to do this. That's an important part of the culture. And then the culture, the final is the was the fourth one they said. The plants, the ideas that go along with, it's something that we're working on up there, looking at teaching people. You teach them about one one little thing, maybe. Maybe you just talk to them about a plant or something. But there's all these cultural concepts. There might be accounts of the past, stories that are associated with that, and language built in there that means this and that. And so it all expands. And so with them, that's kind of what I've been working on.
That's cool. And how would you say, like, the Irish cultural identity here or links in with that, or maybe along those same lines? How is it to be a white Irish boy working, you know, with the elders on these kind of projects?
Sure. Sure. How is it to be a Irishman working in Indian country is an interesting deal. Because one of the things that happens a lot with those guys is people be wannabes. They have people kind of follow, oh, teach me your ways type thing. And for me, being Irish has kind of grounded me in my own identity. I participate in ceremonies with them and stuff because they're my friends. So I'll pray with them and stuff, you know. And it's also given me a place where we can kind of relate in a lot of things. We relate on sacrifice, you know, because that was big growing up. It wasn't to just not eat meat on Friday so you go have a fancy fish dinner. It was maybe eat scrambled, you know, you don't have a fancy meal, scrambled eggs or something. You'd really do something different. And there's a lot of sacrifice within their culture. There's a lot of things that come up. Even sweetgrass is a big part of the culture. Praying and this and that. And it always reminds me of incense at church. Oh, they're coming down the aisle. And you smell that and it puts you in a different place in your head. You automatically, you think different. You're in a different state. And that was that Monsignor Gluchek I told you growing up. That was what he always said to me, you know. The church is supposed to put you in that different place. Because, you know, when Vatican II was coming about, they were going to take all the statues out of the church. And because it was too gaudy, you know, which is kind of a funny concept, but that was kind of the idea. Mm-hmm. And, but it was to put you in that place. And so when I work with the tribes, we talk about those type of things. You know, we talk about how my Irish Catholic upbringing relates to their, you know, Cree upbringing up there. And it has grounded me in it. It's helped me in a lot of ways. Like I said too, I always let them know, you know, when a lot of times they'll introduce themselves, say, you know, they'll introduce themselves as in Cree and they'll greet people in Cree. So I'll say it's Misha Riabardo Boygil Tome Ruga Gagas Tohig in the Great Falls, you know. It's a thing where I make sure that they know too that I am grounded in that. That it's not something where I'm trying to steal something away from them. It's working kind of as a team.
Yeah. How do you feel as a you talked about, you know, sharing Gaelic with your kids?
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about Ojibwe kind of being on its last incarnation?
Yeah.
How do those two link for you?
Yeah, the Ojibwe language disappearing up there on Rocky Boy does kind of concern me in a lot of ways, because it does relate to my family's experience, you know. One of the things that this old guy up there, he says, well, these people always say, you know, that doesn't put food on my table or working this and that. But it really is such an integral part of who they are, that there is going to be a generation down the road that's saying, why didn't you teach us this? Why didn't you save this? Why didn't they do this? And there's Ojibwe spoken in different parts of the country. They're a big bunch. They traveled from back east, and there's a bunch scattered from Canada and Michigan, Wisconsin, all over the place. There's these bunch, but up there it really is disappearing, and we've been making some efforts to deal with it. Recently, we've been in touch with the American Indian Center in Chicago. I have a friend who works there, and they have Ojibwe classes there, and we're talking about having not only people participate in those classes for learning, but also having our elder there, Duncan, participate, because there's different dialects, and people speak differently in different parts. You know, that's the same way as, you know, in America, we, you know, American, we speak different. You know, you go over to Butte and you'll hear a certain dialect, a certain twang that... When I worked in bookstores, I worked in a couple different bookstores, and I could hear the people that come from Butte. I'd recognize. I'd say, "You're from Butte, aren't you?" And they'd say, "Yeah." But yeah, it's sad. It's tough. I honestly think it's kind of gone over the edge where I'd love to say we're going to save it, we're going to do this or that. But I don't think it will up there. I think it is gonna go, and it is a sad thing. I think there'll be people who will probably want to work on it in the future and bring it back. But I think up there, as far as it goes, because you have a couple different bunches, that you'll end up just with Cree speakers in the future.
Mm-hmm. Why is that language so important? You've talked about it connecting to the culture, but...
Yeah. Sure. I think language is so intricate to the cultural experience. When, I mean, you look at the writings of a lot of the great Irish nationalists, you look at Padraig Pearse, because he's the guy you should look at. That was a big deal. The language is so important because it does shape the way you see the world. It shapes the ideas and the concepts. You know, right now, I'm of course speaking to you in English, and that's the language of the conquering people. That's the norm that we've settled on and stuff. But you lose a lot of the subtleties. You lose a lot of the ideas when you move away. I'll give you an example. We would say, "Well, I'm thirsty. I need a drink. I'm thirsty." You wouldn't say that in Irish. You'd say, "Ta orcas orm. The thirst is on me." You know, it's that because you're not thirst. But it's this feeling that comes on you. You're not, you know, it's a less egocentric type thing. Likewise with possessions. Possessions are with you. You don't own a book. The book's with you. You know, those type of subtle things make a big difference. And, you know, for my part, I don't know the language well enough to get it completely. Mm-hmm. I just have these wee hints of that stuff, but I do think it's critical to the understanding of a people, because one of the things these old guys talk about up at the reservation a lot, and I think about this a lot. They say, you know, at some point somebody's going to come to us and say, "Well, what makes you different? We're wearing the same clothes. Our haircuts are the same. You go to the same church. We're speaking the same language. What makes you different?" blood quantum, that's made up. That really is a made up concept. Mm-hmm. And so it's something that I often think about, you know, with my own family, my own self, you know, what is it? What does it mean? Mm-hmm. What does it mean to be Irish if we don't have the language, if we don't have the songs, if we don't have the ceremony to go along with it, you know, and it, does it mean we put on the plastic hat on March 17th and for that day we can be Irish? Mm-hmm. You know, that's a lot of my friends up there at Rocky Boy and in around Indian country in general, they have a Native American week. Mm-hmm. And they kind of jokingly always say, oh, this week we get to be Indians, you know. whereas, you know, I think about that sometimes, you know, they'll have those little plastic hats. I always think about those. How silly is that? These little plastic green hats. And is that going to make me Irish then? Or everybody's Irish on St. Patrick's Day. That thing, it's like, well, what? What does that mean with it, you know? Or it's just kind of one of those things.
Sure. Now, your wife, Virginia, has kind of interesting heritage, right?
Yeah. Yeah, Virginia was adopted during the 70s, during the... there was a time there called the Indian Child Welfare Act was in effect. And the government's idea was, well, we're going to save these Indians from this awful existence that they're growing up on these reservations, and we'll get them out into places where they can flourish and stuff. And so her father was a McGovern. She hasn't followed that up for sure, but I know he's Irish. And her mother was a Chippewa Cree. She is from Rocky Boy. And interestingly enough, it's kind of just serendipity how it all works out. But working up there, we knew some of these names and some of these different things. One of her cousins, or what we found out is her close cousins, I visit with him all the time. He'd be a second cousin, I guess. Depends on how you count kin. Mm-hmm. But we were doing a survey up there at Rocky Boy. We found a grave site. They were going to put a house, and we said, well, let's move the house away. It's going to be on top of this grave. And we did some research. Turned out it was her grandfather who was buried in this place, Norbert Houle. Was his name. And so it's like my friend Alvin said, he says, it's a big world, but it's not that big. And that's kind of the case that we've run across up there. She has a lot of relatives that I work with, and that's kind of helped actually, because a big part of doing anything is making that connection and making that relationship with people. And working with those guys, that's been the case, you know. Then I'm related in a way, even if it's by marriage. But we can make that connection.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. So, your kids are going to be very Irish, and you know, a good chunk of Cree and things as well. Where do you, as a father, where do you set those kind of priorities for them to be connected with their cultures?
Sure. Well, for me, it's been a big part. Of course, like I said, you know, if you went into our vehicle right now and you turned on the CD player, you'd hear music, and a good part of that music is Irish music. Not all of it. Mm-hmm. We listen to some other stuff too, but there's a lot of it that's Irish music that we do and listen to. We make Irish foods, like I say, and you know, we had parsnip soup last night for dinner. That type of stuff is really important, as well as the Cree side. You know, there's been a lot of interest from those folks in the kids and making sure, you know, we have, one of the older ladies up there that, I work with her husband quite a bit, but she really is kind of taking Virginia and Mariah under her wing, and she says, "You know, well, we're gonna, you know, we'll sweat together, and we'll talk about things together, because you need this education." And that's a big part. And you know, I try and relate to them some of the stuff, not only that I learned from my own self growing up, the Irish part of it, but also things that we do up there that relate to them, because it's important for them to be connected with that. I don't think I need to draw any strict boundaries on them as far as, you know, you're going to be this or that. But I want them to know that stuff and have the opportunity, so they don't go, "Well, Dad, why didn't you ever tell us about this?" Or, "You know, I never had the opportunity. If I'm half Indian, why don't I know about this stuff?" Because that's what a lot of these kids are on the reservation run into. They'll say they're kind of embarrassed when they get out. And people will look to them as, "Well, you're the Indian kid. What do Indians do with this or that?" And, you know, a lot of them don't know, because it isn't a part of their growing up. Because, like I said, I mean, there's a lot of Christians and a lot of things that wasn't a part of what they did. And so that traditional upbringing that people always think of as what makes an Indian, a lot of people don't have. And so with my kids, I'm not trying to raise them as, you know, traditional this or that, but at least so they have an idea. You know, it's funny. My daughter, she was in second grade here in Potomac, and they had this guy come out, Indian Education for All. Mariah's worked with Indians since she was a baby. You know, she's been out there and stuff. So this guy comes to the class, and he says, "Well, what do Indians dress like?" And Mariah's kind of confused, and she said, "Well, they just dress in clothes. Like, I mean, just, what do you, you know? Oh, no, they dress in buckskin and this and that," you know, trying to project this thing. And she came home in second grade, and she was like, "I don't think that guy knew what he was talking about." You know, so it's kind of funny.
Yeah. It is what, you brought up your grandma a lot. Grandma, was it Jessie? Oh, Kelly. Grandma Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
A lot. What's a memory you have of her?
My grandma Kelly?
Like? What was visiting her like?
Yeah, I have, you know, I didn't mention my grandma Boyle, because I was actually really close to her as well. Mm-hmm. But my grandma Kelly, I have a lot of really good memories of my grandma Kelly. Almost every day I cook. If you look over on my stove, there's a cast iron pan over there probably. It's either on top or probably underneath. But that was my grandma Kelly's. And that was a big part of my memories with her. She'd be cooking food in there. She'd make donuts. She'd make everything in that cast iron deal. And that was a big part of it. Another big memory of my grandma Kelly was when my cousin Sam and I'd be causing trouble. She was, how can I put this? Kind of a equal opportunity enforcer. She'd grab the wooden spoon, and she'd come out, and she'd just be, "Now you quit fighting with each other," and she'd be hitting us both. And boy, you kind of wanted to give her a good shot, because she didn't care where she really hit you with that wooden spoon. If it was the back or the ear or the elbow or whatever, you know. So it was, you didn't try and scatter too much. And she was always a good sport too. You know, she was a crossing guard for the Blaine School up there in Walkerville. And, or I guess that's right on the edge there, but between Walkerville and Centerville. But she was totally blind when she finally retired. She lived to be 90, 92 or 94. She worked there into her late 80s. She was still the crossing guard at the Blaine. And she couldn't see. And so she'd be standing there, and she'd have her thing. And I mean, I didn't go to school there, but you know, my cousins and stuff would say that the kids just tell her, "Okay, Mrs. Kelly, it's okay now," you know. And then she'd walk out, and they'd cross and stuff and everything. So, but she was really an amazing lady in so many ways. She was She was really a spiritual lady. She believed in a lot of the kind of, she had a lot of beliefs in kind of the old ways, I guess I'd say. As far as, you know, she'd talk about the ghosts and the banshees and things, and they weren't, she didn't tell them a story. She talked about them. This is an account. This isn't a myth that we're talking about here. These are accounts. And you know, she talked about things like that. I have a lot of memories of that. She was the last of my grandparents to leave, and that was tough too because she was my kind of last link to that generation, and so that was kind of she was special because of that too.
Sounds like a good gal.
Yeah.
What about your Grandma Boyle then?
My memories of my grandma Boyle, I have a lot. She grew up there in Great Falls. She worked at the flower shop there, the Electric City Conservatory in Great Falls. And we did a lot because she couldn't drive. And so my dad would go pick her up every day from work and stuff. She babysat me a lot after school. And in the summers when I was in Great Falls, my parents, you know, they didn't get the summers off. So she would go work with that. I would go stay with her. And that was always fun. I'd spend the night with her. Always at New Year's, my folks would go do stuff, and I'd spend the night with my grandma. And I remember one year, I kicked her out of bed. I guess I was a crazy sleeper, and I kicked her out of bed. But I had a lot of really good memories of her. I'd go, you know, even as when I got older, and I didn't need babysitting or anything, I'd ride my bike over to her house and stay with her. And when I was little, sometimes my folks, they'd go to this church deal on Tuesday nights called Altria, which is kind of a Kersele deal. It's a kind of a, I don't know if you know about that, but it's a movement within the Catholic Church, kind of a thing that my mom really especially enjoyed. But on Tuesday nights they'd go to that, and I'd call up my grandma on the phone, and we'd watch the same TV show. She'd be watching at her house, and I'd be watching at my house, and we'd talk about the TV show, you know, just kind of goofy stuff like that.
What
So
other stuff would you do with her?
we did all sorts of stuff. She was the type of grandma, when she'd watch me, she didn't just say, "Well, just go about and we'll do this." She'd get down and play with you. She'd go out in the yard. I remember going outside, and we would do, of course, cowboys was a big thing that we'd always play. And I'd take my stick horse, and she'd say, "Well, you better go out to the other end and fix the fence out there. Oh, we're having trouble with cattle rustlers." And you know, she'd just keep it going like that, and I'd always, oh, I'd have fun with her like that. So we did a lot of stuff, you know, all the holidays and everything. 'Cause she left when I was a senior in high school, is when she passed away. And so that was kind of a, you know, that's a pretty poignant time for a lad anyways, 'cause you're transitioning from a youth, and then you're getting ready to be an adult. And so that was kind of a poignant, I guess, in that way, that's when she left, because that was a big part of my youth growing up, was my grandma. We called her Nana, and her real name was Rose Elizabeth O'Boyle. She was a Davidson, and her mother's maiden name was Hamill. And they were from her parents, they ended up in Butte, but or in Anaconda, and they were from Tyrone and Armagh in Ireland. And they ended up over there. But I have a lot of really good memories. She really had a lot of history, and she did convey a lot of information as far as, you know, where the family was from and how things were passed down, and all that type of stuff.
You mentioned before you're kind of the family historian, as it were, to a certain point.
Yeah,
How does
I
that
guess
play out?
I am a family historian for my generation. I think every generation or so has a somebody who kind of is charged with taking up that. And for my family, that would be me now. My mom did a lot of it for her generation, and she's passed a lot of that on to me, and a lot of the pictures and names and documentation. My aunt, I have an aunt that lives over in Seattle. Helen Leary is her name, and she does some too. But for my generation, really, there hasn't been another one of my cousins or anything. Well, I guess I take that back. One of my cousins has done some genealogy and stuff, but I know when people say, "Oh, well, I've got these old tapes you can have of the family, and I've got, we've got some old pictures we need to go through," or now if they need a picture, "Could you email a picture, this picture or that to me and stuff?" So,
Archivalist totally.
yeah.
That's good. Is there anything else that you kind of wanted to talk about? Is there anything else that is kind of important to you along these lines? Anything we touched on you want to go into more?
Well,
Time to think about it if you want.
yeah, it's I think this is such a worthwhile project. It has a lot of resonance with a lot of people. It touches a lot of people. I mean, there's what, 40 million people in the United States with Irish heritage. And you look in at a state like Montana, and it goes back really to the formation of the state as a state, with Thomas Maher and Maher of the Sword, and his kind of ideas that, we had this Irish nationalist who had escaped from Van Diemen's Land to come over here and set up a new Ireland over here in Montana, so to speak. And I think that this project really, really taps into some important things that right now you're looking at a deal where a lot of the people who came to Montana, a lot of the Irish were here working in the mines in Butte and this and that. But a lot of Montana wasn't settled until, really the early 1900s with the Expanded Homestead Act of 1912 and that type of thing really got people moving in here and expanding. So I think that in a lot of ways, like I was talking about with Rocky Boy, how it's a fairly recent development. Montana's a fairly recent development. And you don't have to go back that far to trace your roots back to Ireland and see how that ties to the way things are here and the way that we do things every day. And a project like this can tie that community back together, and remind us what that means, and the next generation hopefully won't point their finger and say, why didn't you get this information down when you had the chance? Why didn't you do that?" And so hopefully, this will lend itself to that, because I think that we have an opportunity. But I think that's probably as far. I mean, of course, there's a million things the lad could talk about, but
Some important ones for you, huh?
yeah. For now, I think that's the important ones. There's names and that type of stuff, when you think about family and family names and how those are passed on, that's something that certainly within my family. That's important. I'm named after my grandpa Kelly. was important character growing up and stuff, but you know, my dad's name was Mike. I've got a brother named Mike. I got a nephew named Mike. I got cousins named Mike, but different deals, you know, and the same way how those names get passed on, and it's kind of fascinating, you know, my dad growing up, Mike and Pat, it was the two brothers, and of course that was the stereotypical. They used to have a cartoon with Mike and Pat as these two Irish goons, and it was always kind of funny. But you know, those things are kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. How those names and ideas and ties get passed on with those names. When we were naming my son, we named him Liam, which is, of course, the English use William, but it's the proper form is Liam. And that was a family name to a degree. That I was reading, Liam Clancy had just come out with his book, Mountain of Women. And I was reading that at the time. And that was part of the reason we named him that. And his first name, his full first name is Liam Padraig, after Padraig Pierce. And I think those names are so important because they tie people. Mm-hmm. And later on, he'll think of those, you know, he'll be tied to that stuff forever that way. And that's part of another thing that can be passed on and tied.
Keep those connections going.
Yeah.
Right. Well, there's a thousand other things I think I could dive in with you, but I think maybe we can take a break here.
All right. Okay. This bright light's getting me anyway. Yeah, it's frying my eyes.
Sold out of it, huh?